Hey guys, Ryan Krause here. I'm curious, are you happy with the amount of money you make? How does the opportunity to start making $40,000 a year sound? Even better, what if I told you you could double that to $80,000 in just a few years? Do I have your attention? Well, if so, you should check out truck driving jobs. With the improved economy and high flourishing commercial trucking industry, the demand for truck drivers is definitely high right now. CDL.com makes it easy for you to get a commercial driving license and find the job that's right for your needs. Find opportunities in your town or over the road. Create a driver profile. Access high-paying, long-term, and short-term truck driving jobs. Plus, apply to these jobs in just minutes. With plenty of new jobs and schools around the country, you can get your trucking career started at CDL.com. Explore a truckload of jobs for the trucker in you. Again, that's CDL.com. Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, returning for part two of the Q&A session, in which I'll be answering a multitude of inquiries that I've received over the last couple of years, spanning everything from questions about true crime, to my process, to just about anything you can imagine. Okay, so just a quick couple of notes here, and then we'll get this thing rolling. As always, most episodes of this podcast are available only by premium subscription on coldcasemurdermysteries.com, so be sure to head on over today and sign up for access to the catalog. You can also download the free Cold Case Murder Mysteries app in the App Store for your iPhone and in Google Play for the Android version. If you find time, your 5-star ratings and reviews wherever you listen are greatly appreciated and help new listeners find the show. Finally, if you're feeling generous, any donations to the show can be made on coldcasemurdermysteries.com. Just look for the donate button on the homepage. All right, that's enough of the business. Let's do this. First up, am I a cat or a dog person? Well, I definitely prefer dogs to cats, but they clearly both have their advantages and disadvantages. You can leave your cat home alone for like 250 days, and if the animal has food and water, it will probably do just fine. But dogs are sometimes like, oh, you're working an hour late tonight? Okay, then I'll just take a dump on the carpet and hide with that shameful look on my face when you come home. Or maybe I'll overturn the trash can to really send the message. Better yet, how about I just tear the couch cushions to pieces while I'm at it? So I think the care you put into them is equivalent to the reward, meaning cats tend to be more like adults while dogs are more like children. As a pack animal, the dog seems to accept and understand its role and realizes you're the alpha in the pack. So it takes more of a childlike disposition than the cat, which is very charming, but also means they require a greater degree of care. If you put a leash on your dog, the level of excitement can get totally out of control. But if you put a leash on your cat, well, that could get a little scary. Cats are as independent as they can be, while the dog is like, I can't believe you're not taking me to work. I'll have separation anxiety all day and won't stop barking until I pass out from exhaustion. Meanwhile, the cat is like, I just don't care. I grew up with a lot of animals in the house, for the most part, everything from cats and dogs to exotic parrots to fish and even water turtles. We even had a big snapping turtle. It was a great experience because it taught me a lot about having empathy for creatures who often suffer at the hands of human cruelty. Yeah, there's always that slight sense of guilt about keeping some of this wildlife in a domestic situation, but then you consider the other side of that coin and realize their lives are free of some of the physical and emotional stresses of nature. I think that speaks very strongly to a dilemma we all have as humans as well. There's part of us that wants to be this adventurous bird that always flies from one place to the next, free of the shackles of staying grounded, stuck in one place. We want to travel and explore everything life has to offer. And then on the other hand, there's the part that says, I get tired sometimes, and lonely, and need a nest to which I can return and see my loved ones. So, I think we all struggle with those sentiments, and it's evident in the fact most of us seek to have a nest from which we can fly on occasion to get away. But yeah, it's really interesting to me how the process of domesticating animals replicates that dilemma. I mean, Is the snapping turtle better off in a pond somewhere? Or is this creature happier with the guarantees of domesticity? And the irony is that they can't articulate an answer to the question. Neither can we. And so, I think there's no clear answer except to realize that, like the animals, we simply need to adapt to the circumstances that arise due to fate. If the world has dropped a baby in your lap, then that beautiful creature requires a nest. But if a job offer comes from 5,000 miles across the world, then maybe you need wings. So, I think what these animals teach us is to adapt to the situation. There are advantages related to freedom that come with being exposed to danger out in the world, and other reasons to seek the safety of the nest, such as comfort. Of course, I'm talking about domestic animals here, and not necessarily referencing a dolphin, which would normally be in the ocean, but is, you know, stuck at a place like SeaWorld or something like that. Obviously, they're better off in the ocean. Okay, next question. Of all the places you've traveled, which did you like the best? And what is the one place you want to visit but never have? See, this is difficult because I really haven't made most of my travel decisions in the past. Usually when I go on vacation, there's a woman involved, which means as soon as I pick some dark, dreary, mysterious place I'm dying to see, that decision gets vetoed in favor of going to a sunny beach somewhere that looks like every other beach in the world, and leads to me getting really drunk, excessively sunburnt, and depressed, instead of exploring something interesting. But if we're talking about a beachy type of place, my favorite would be Jamaica. I think I've been there 3 times in my life, one of which was on a cruise as a kid. Years later, I went there with my girlfriend at the time, and she wanted to get away from the resort to do something a bit more authentic, so to speak. So we were in Negril at the time, which I think is a couple of hours' drive from the airport, but it tends to be more genuinely Jamaican in its presentation than Montego Bay, which is pretty much as touristy as it gets. So she was definitely the type to go against the grain like that. So she gets this idea, we should take a cab way up into the hills to go on a river tour. And I was like, you do realize there will be guys with machetes hanging around, staring at you in your bikini and gossiping with each other about it. So she tells me that's ridiculous, and we get a ride up into the hills and step out of the cab to see just a couple of locals hanging around, which were mostly women. My girlfriend turns to me and says, see, I told you it wouldn't be creepy. That's when our guide takes us past this small ramshackle building made of wood, where they have changing rooms that you can like basically see inside because the cracks are so big between the wood. And as we walk past it, there's a group of about 10 guys standing on the other side. They all instantly stare at her in her bikini and make comments to each other. And as we get closer, I notice one of them is holding a machete. I turn to her with this huge smile, and she glares at me like, don't you even say it. So we go on this river tour, and the guides were really nice and helpful, but super creepy. They stared at my girlfriend the whole time. I asked her if she was okay during this time, and she says, yeah, at least the guy with the machete isn't here. So soon after, we finished the tour and returned to the place where the cab driver was still waiting for us. The fare was huge, so he didn't care. He just waited. Now, as we're about to leave, a woman approaches us, points to a nearby building, and asks if we want to have lunch at their restaurant. The first thing I notice is that nobody else is eating there, which is usually not a good sign. But my girlfriend felt obligated, as, you know, she was pretty much adventurous, so she says, yeah, sure. So we go over and sit. The place is clean, and the dishes on the menu sounded like they'd be good. The woman serving us was really hospitable, and the service was excellent. So, we both ordered the same thing, which was basically a chicken entree with a side of rice. As the server walks away with the menus, she goes back into the kitchen and starts calling somebody's name. It's pretty loud. I couldn't understand exactly what the name was because her accent was just really thick, but moments later, I see the guy with the machete approaching, and I'm like, okay, this is about to turn into a horror movie. What the hell is going on here? But the guy walks right past us, just offering a smile along the way. So I'm like, man, I don't know what I'm thinking. My imagination is wild. That's when the guy walks into a fenced-in area nearby, where I see a small collection of farm animals. and it hits me. I make the connection between the machete and a handful of chickens walking around behind the fence. So I turn to my girlfriend, and she doesn't seem to be thinking what I'm thinking. So I just wait for her to catch on. That's when this guy with the machete starts chasing chickens around the coop. You know, it's kind of a free-range thing. They're not in cages. Suddenly, I see the light bulb come on in her eyes. She turns to me and says, "He's not doing what I think he's doing, is he?" And I respond with a question. I'm like, "Do you see a supermarket around here?" And she opens her mouth to say something else, but stops right as this guy grabs one of the chickens, right by the neck. And of course, if you're sensitive to these type of things, you might want to put your hands over your ears right now. So this guy chops the chicken's head off on top of a flat tree stump and carries the corpse back into the restaurant, headless. And a few minutes later, we could smell chicken cooking. My girlfriend looks at me and says, "What if we just left?" I'm like, "Did you see the guy with the machete? Do you want him chasing you?" So we stayed, and it turned out to be one of the better meals we've ever had. But to this day, I can't even hear the word chicken without reminiscing about the guy with the machete. Anyway, there are a lot of places I'd like to travel. I was planning to do some hiking in the Pacific Northwest of the U.S. this summer, as well as in the Canadian Rockies in Alberta, but pretty much got too busy with work. I'd also love to visit Ireland and Germany. Those are two places I haven't been, and I have ancestry there. Japan is another one. I've always been intrigued by their culture. Iceland is definitely interesting, too. Let's add South America to that list as well. I haven't been anywhere on that continent before, and there are just a lot of really beautiful places to visit. Okay, next question. This one's on a little bit more of a serious level. Now, I've received this inquiry from several people over the past 2 years, in different forms specific to each person's circumstance, but I'll try to generalize it when offering an answer so that it isn't just specific to any one person's circumstances. We'll just use this example. A young woman who is bisexual and has traditionally held long-term relationships with men switched gears and decided to enter that same type of relationship with another woman, which she found to be a more natural fit for her. In the process, her family and friends had concerns about how different her life would be as a result of that choice, and it caused her to ponder the answers. So, she wanted to know, in the absence of entering a long-term relationship with a man that would produce children, what her role then becomes in evolution in the absence of reproductive value. Well, that's an incredibly interesting question, and surprisingly, has a very simple answer. Those who have participated in male-female relationships since the beginning of time have always faced the least resistance from society for their natural disposition because the technology required to reproduce was provided to them by nature, aka evolution. A man and woman could always produce a child, and so always possessed proof of their evolutionary worth, or purpose, as the technology to accommodate such a situation is afforded by nature. So, because the technology has always existed to allow a man and woman to reproduce, social acceptance wasn't something that needed to be earned through long-term conflict. That type of relationship was normalized in society starting on day one. But in terms of the LGBTQ community, and all things related, we start way back in the earliest years of modern humanity with no understanding why nature has offered this disposition. Society would think, well, if you're different, in the sense that you don't traditionally reproduce, then it must be an abomination of nature. It must be a mistake that needs to be corrected. So much of the world held that belief for a very long time, and to a certain extent, in some places, those beliefs are still widely held. Now, evolution, like I said, is a primitive design. Its blueprint is no different today than it was a couple of 100,000 years ago. It will never change. Society has to drive change, which evolution allows in accordance with the pace of technology. So, right off the bat, what we have to understand is that social acceptance of non-traditional relationships, meaning those that don't naturally or biologically produce a child born of the sexual union of the parents, will run concurrently with the technology that exposes their true purpose in that context. When the technology is ready, the evolutionary purpose of such people and relationships will be undeniable, and therefore finally achieve full social acceptance. Until that time, there will still be hateful, ignorant people out to put a stop to what you're doing, and likewise, those who remain indifferent through their actions but still disapprove. So essentially, the LGBTQ community is a billboard, an increasingly prominent advertisement in society that challenges our primitive nature and urges acceptance at the same pace in which technology moves us toward becoming artificial intelligence. The broad idea here, in the grand scheme of evolution, is to slowly but surely normalize androgyny, because the future would be fully androgynous in AI. There won't be reproduction through biological means. There will be replication by way of technology. You won't need gender or a sexual preference. None of that will matter. You'll be whatever the hell you want to be. From a technological standpoint, we aren't there yet. So people who identify as gay, lesbian, trans, asexual, and so on, while they currently have the greatest level of acceptance society has ever afforded, still face an uphill battle. They endure anything from verbal hate to physical violence to discrimination that comes in many forms. So, as you've heard me say, society is a manipulation of evolution, here's what I mean in this specific instance. People who don't agree with your lifestyle will fight against it in various ways, and because you're seeing this hate coming from the faces of other people in society, you'll believe that they're the evil. But they're not. They, just as we all are comprised of puppets evolution utilizes to prevent social acceptance, until which time the technology arrives. Right now, if you have progressive values and a high level of empathy, you're at the front of the line in terms of evolution's design to allow societal acceptance of non-traditional gender roles, relationships, and sexual orientation. Evolution designs that type of brain to first accommodate social changes. They're the leaders of social change, those who advocate for the oppressed more often and with greater passion than everybody else. And then you basically have a sliding scale working through the spectrum from there. So, the people most likely to treat you the worst are those with extremely conservative values and low levels of empathy. They will be the last people to conform, finally doing so as the technology arrives to prove artificial replication is superior to biological reproduction. If you're a trans person, you know that there are more options than ever available today to accommodate your physical and emotional transformation from surgery to hormone therapy and so on. The technology to accommodate these goals is improving all the time. Likewise, social acceptance follows at the same pace. It is an impossibility for the world to just wake up tomorrow and offer their acceptance, to admit they were wrong. Social acceptance is entirely dependent upon technological advance and in relation to survival of the species. So, as we indulge better, faster, and more efficient ways to produce androgynous technology related to AI, leading to ensuring survival by way of replication rather than reproduction, social acceptance of people who identify as part of this community will become more and more prevalent. The reason evolution has to use us like this is that all of these changes come at the expense of tremendous human suffering. So it designs brains to act in a particular manner, so that you always point the finger at the evil, hateful human face in front of you instead of criticizing the design. It doesn't want you to see the game, or else you'll realize you're being manipulated by evolution for the purpose of technological advance. This goes for all social issues. As I mentioned in the Columbine episode, racism is nothing more than genetic fear. Evolution designed the most adventurous of early modern humans to go off exploring the world while designing others to remain traditional and stick to their roots. The people who moved to cold areas with harsh winters were forced to build technology related to light or heat and indulged a greater degree of conquest through technological change along the way. One of the byproducts of this design is a physical representation of genetic predisposition, meaning those with brains designed to indulge such a lifestyle were afforded lighter skin. All it meant is that they were creating more light by way of technology at a much greater pace than the people designed with more traditional brains that stayed closer to their roots in warmer places where people had darker skin and less of a need to produce sophisticated technology to survive. So the difference in skin color became a genetic marker to suggest explicitly what type of brain you had. Evolution wanted those with similar brains, and thereby skin color, to reproduce with one another because that would offer their children genetics conducive to producing the greatest amount of technological advance in return. But again, it's a primitive design. It doesn't change. Society has to make the changes, which coincide with technology. As our technological gains mount, the fear slowly dissipates along with the hate because evolution has brought us to a point where such considerations are increasingly irrelevant or perhaps entirely obsolete and nonsensical altogether. If you look at the nature of racism as compared to the plight of the LGBTQ community, it's easy to see the similarities. Those with the most progressive values and empathetic brains were the first to shed their racist feelings and actions in society, while those with the most conservative values and least empathetic brains are clearly proving to be the last. All of these social issues have a finish line in evolution, which is when we adopt AI as our new form and transcend evolution through replacement of our operating system or brain. The world simply is not ever going to be a better place because people wake up one day and say, hey, today's the day to make everything right. That's an impossibility. The brain is nothing more than a design that mirrors human evolution. They are synonymous. I mean, just look at those personality tests you can take that designate you as being a certain type of person who offers certain traits. Where do you think we got the idea for that? It's what evolution does too. Everything is everything. If you see it in the world, it's because evolution is doing it. It's in the design. So, the next time you manipulate somebody, or have it done to you, just remember that manipulation is exactly what evolution does to society. You wouldn't be able to conjure it unless it was already in the design. But what I think we should note here is that if you are a part of one of these oppressed groups, destined to suffer for the desires of evolution, it means that you play a much more important role in the process than everybody else. The change that you're bringing to the world is profound, to the greatest extent possible. All of this suffering is creating a society that will ultimately extract race, gender, and biological reproduction, normalizing androgyny and paving the way to artificial intelligence where you can finally be whatever the hell you want. That's what society fights for every day. The freedom to be anything and anybody you so choose, free of persecution from others. Technology is making that happen. So, back to the original question, that's the role you play in evolution as part of a community that doesn't reproduce biologically. We have more parents today than ever whose children are not the product of non-traditional female-male relationships. It's normalizing the social sentiment that kids can excel in such environments. Eventually, as the technology improves, we'll be trying to prove artificial humans born of technology rather than biology can do the same. As the technology rises, bringing us closer to AI, the social oppression dissipates and non-traditional roles become increasingly normalized and more so accepted. Of course, there's a lot more to say about that, but for the sake of moving along in this episode, let's take the next question. Oh, this one might be my favorite. Oh boy. You've said you don't like social media. If you could get rid of one platform, what would it be? Now that's interesting. I think we all like looking at pretty people, so I'd probably keep Instagram. Twitter, of all the options, has more practical value than the rest, but is badly misused, in my opinion, in the sense that it's often rendered a place to blow hot air in the absence of action. It's a great place to make jokes and post memes, or even do a GoFundMe for a sick child, or promote a business, but it can be incredibly archaic in the sense that it caters to an oratory type of world that no longer exists. Debate had much more practical value back in the day, but apps like Twitter have given rise to an excessive amount of talk that isn't necessarily followed up with action. It's obvious why that happens. Creating change and taking action in the world to advocate something or somebody is difficult work and often thankless, offering delayed gratification at best. But posting a misspelled, grammatically incorrect tweet denouncing that same thing only takes a few seconds and offers tremendous emotional rewards in return when other people, who also aren't taking any action, keep retweeting your sentiments and hitting the like button. An amazing experiment, in my opinion, would be to see how our behavior changes on Twitter in the absence of likes or retweets. Meaning, what would we post if we weren't offered the instant gratification of numerous emotional rewards through retweets and favorites? With that said, though, I think Twitter still has more practical value and is sometimes used to generate significant change, so I'm still going with it. Twitter it is. As I've mentioned previously, I just can't stomach the wall of happiness on Facebook. If I'm on Twitter and see you telling everyone you're so depressed you couldn't get out of bed today, then I really don't want to go to Facebook and see every picture you posted features you smiling. But that's just me. I'm a strange dude, for sure. Okay, next question. Even if you don't believe in aliens, do you think it's possible they could still exist? Definitely. I don't think we have any reason to believe they exist in our universe, but as we exist, it's certainly possible other intelligent life does as well. Now, as I've said in the past, I don't think any of the lights or UFOs we witness in the Earth's atmosphere have any correlation to intelligent life beyond what we know. I think that's really silly. I mean, if you break down the logic, it just doesn't work. But on the other hand, as I also say, everything is everything. The universe, our brains, and evolution itself are synonymous, born of a singular idea or action. Yet, when we look at Earth as a planet, what do you immediately notice we have nearby? Neighboring planets. And when you look at the stars, what do they have? Neighboring stars. You'll notice this pattern throughout the universe, and even more so, right next door to you. If you look to your left or right, there's often someone standing next to you. If you rent an apartment, there are neighboring apartments. And what's really interesting for my crazy brain is that when I watch a movie or TV show that takes place in a suburban neighborhood, and there's one of those drone shots from above, or even from a helicopter or a crane, there's just something truly profound about that visual. On the surface, it offers a look at a community and society on Earth, but still, we are surrounded by neighbors. So, in the same way other planets aren't livable or accessible, and you are not permitted to just walk into your neighbor's apartment or house because it's locked and you need permission to enter, I think our world tends to work like that. Physics offers us a structural look at our universe, but our understanding of it is bound to that which we can theorize and subsequently prove. In areas like quantum physics and similar endeavors, we sometimes deal with a more speculative version of that, though, meaning that the math seems to indicate it's true, but we aren't able to see or prove that reality actually exists beyond creating the theory. So, no, I don't think we are visited or ever have been visited by aliens in our galaxy, or even the entirety of the universe we know. But things such as parallel universes or multiverses are certainly a possibility. Our ignorance that leads us to being able to answer the question is undoubtedly due to a lack of appropriate technology, but that will change over time, allowing us to examine these ideas on a more practical level and also give more concise answers based in hard science. Okay, next question. What's the worst thing you've ever said to somebody? Oh, that's a great one. You know, Like most people, I've definitely had some arguments that caused me to say things I really regret, but those statements were always in the heat of the moment, and in most cases the other person said terrible things to me as well, or did terrible things that caused me to act that way. I think a lot of times we have relationships with people, whether it's romantic or just as friends, or even a working relationship that's come to a time and place when it doesn't serve a purpose anymore. And usually people drift apart, and it's mostly unspoken why, like the way it would happen if you didn't talk to most of your college friends years after graduating. But some relationships require actually having some sort of climactic conflict that ends it. Basically, you tell each other to fuck off in your own way, and that's that. So, in those situations, I generally don't have regrets. For me, it's the ones where nobody was rude to you or mean in any way, but you still lashed out at them or did something beneath the standard of your character you normally display. So I have one memory from high school that made me legendary among my friends for a short time, but clearly because we were all very immature and thought it was cool. But here goes. This one has kind of haunted me because all I had to do was pretend for another person for about 5 seconds and instead chose to say the rudest thing possible. Anyhow, it was my senior year of high school and I got involved with the new girl who transferred there from another school district. She was a really nice person and very interesting too. So after we dated for a short while, it was that time of year when the prom was on the horizon. Everybody started asking for dates. And so everybody else wanted to know who you were going with. And the pressure mounted quickly, so I just asked her, and of course, we were already together, so she said yes. Soon after, though, I ghosted her because I just wasn't feeling it, and was too immature at the time to confront her like a real man. So we didn't speak after that, obviously, which means we never discussed anything about the prom. I felt like getting another date would be really shallow, so I just kind of let it go and didn't know what I was going to do. A few weeks before the prom, she calls me to tell me about her dress and asks if it's going to clash in any way with my tux. I was caught off guard and didn't want to make things worse, so I just ended up going to the prom with her, which was a huge mistake. I mean, it was dreadful. We wanted nothing to do with each other after the first 2 minutes. But we did make it through the night, and we were about to graduate, so no big deal, it would all be over soon. A couple of weeks later, when we only had a few days of high school left, she picked up the photos from the prom, which I'm sure are all digital these days, but at the time they still gave you like an actual package full of pics. The idea was that one person in the couple would pick them up at school, and then you would divide them afterward. So my date went to pick them up, and then approached me at my locker near the end of the school day. She was actually smiling and being really friendly with me. There was apparently no ill will at all. She looked really hopeful and happy. And that's when she showed me the pics and asked, "Do you want to go sit down somewhere and choose the ones you want?" And without a second's thought, I just instantly responded with, "Nah, I'm good. You can keep them." And walked away as her jaw dropped to the floor. She couldn't believe it. I didn't want anything to do with these pics. I didn't even want one of them. And I'm not sure I understood the magnitude of what I said at the time. I was just thinking, well, we're done, and have been done, ever since the prom, and now we're graduating, never to see each other again, so what's the point? But I was wrong. It didn't occur to me that this was her senior prom, and taking the time to divide those pics was the least I could do to make the event feel like it was worthwhile, and even more importantly, make her feel like she was worthwhile, even special. I mean, she obviously got her hair done, looked for the perfect dress, searched for the right makeup, and so many other things I just didn't appreciate because I didn't have that perspective until I matured a bit. But it was her senior prom, and even if I wasn't special to her, and vice versa, these were memories tied to emotions. You want to be able to look back at these moments with fondness rather than pain. Of course, I soon learned for a fact that she was devastated by what I said, and I was really embarrassed, but I figured I'd never see her again. A few weeks later, while a bunch of us were partying, someone got the idea that we should go egg another person's house. Her name came up, because her parents had this house that was like wall-to-wall windows on the side facing the street. So I was in the car when this happened, but I didn't participate. Even still, I felt terrible about it. I was like, I'm never going anywhere near her again. And she ended up moving, so that was that. But you know how bad things come in threes. I started community college in the fall and showed up for my first class on the first day. I got a ride from someone else, so I ended up being about 20 minutes early, and I was the first person to arrive in the room. As I'm wondering who will be in this class, guess who's the first person to walk in that door behind me? Talk about awkward. She sat at the other end of the room, near the front, so we didn't even have to look at each other. A little bit of time passes, and suddenly the whole room is full, class is about to start, and I'm like, you know what? This isn't terrible. We can't even see each other right now. That's when the professor walks in, says hello, and suddenly announces that he uses assigned seating. I was like, oh no, karma is about to give me a swift kick in the ass. And it did. He sat us right next to each other. I mean, like elbow to elbow. It was ridiculous. I mean, it was the worst silence I've ever known. I mean, there wasn't just one elephant in the room. This was a stampede. A total pressure cooker. I felt like I was about to sweat. I didn't know what to do, but realized this situation wouldn't work. I think to myself, okay, you have to say something. You have to do something to make it right. So I turn to her and look right at her. I'm staring, but the words aren't coming out. I have no idea what to say. Suddenly, she turns her head to me, totally stone-faced, and I'm still at a loss for words. And that's when she says, is it going to be you or me? I paused for a moment and suddenly stood up and walked out of the classroom. I went down to the commons, where I immediately dropped that class. After that, I never saw her again. And as far as I'm concerned, we were even. I took one for the team, but I'm not sure if I've ever forgiven myself for what I said. I should have just taken the pictures like she asked. Okay, next question. Oh, this one's beyond brilliant. Would you rather have dinner with Dahmer, a date with Eileen Wuornos, or have John Wayne Gacy entertain at your kid's birthday party as a clown? I'm assuming none of the above isn't a choice here. I have to choose, huh? Oh boy, dinner with Dahmer is gag-worthy. I mean, that just makes me cringe. It's just, no. No. Eileen is prone to fits of rage and carries a gun. She also likes to shoot men, so I don't know if I would want a chance pissing her off. Gacy was a very sick dude and also quite prolific in terms of the number of people he killed. But I don't recall him crossing the line with kids while working as a clown. So if I could supervise directly, I'd probably have to go with hiring Gacy for the party. Sounds pretty creepy, but if I have to choose, let's do that. Again, I feel dirty for even answering that, but I'm still very happy I am not eating with Dahmer. Alright, next up. What murder houses or haunted houses have you seen? Which ones do you want to see? Well, I've said on the show before that I've been to the JonBenet Ramsey house many times, but even though I'm basically obsessed with that case, I've only visited so often because I used to live in the area and I went hiking near there. I can't think of any others I've seen off the top of my head, but here are some I'd love to visit. The Amityville Horror House is a great one. Super creepy, both from the standpoint of the original murders and the haunting reported to have overcome the premises in the aftermath. I haven't been back to the East Coast in years, but I might have to make that one a priority when I do. Let's see. I'd love to see the area where the Keddy murders took place, even though the cabins are gone. I'd like to stay at the Cecil in downtown LA, which is now Stay on Main, in one of the many infamous rooms in that place where prominent names in the true crime world have checked in, like Elisa Lam or Richard Ramirez. Let's see. The Villisca Axe Murders House is in Iowa. That's another one, and it's a place where you can actually book the room for the night. Although I don't think they have AC, so maybe summer's not a great choice. I'd have to check on that. But the Clutter House in Holcomb, Kansas, which was the infamous locale used in Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. I would definitely love to see that one for sure. I've been to the property where the Manson family murdered Sharon Tate and her friends back in 1969. I was able to pull up outside the front gate and check out the entrance to the place. It was really cool. I mean, it has a certain mystique to it, but when you realize the old house is gone, replaced by a modern mansion, it doesn't quite have the same effect as it might otherwise. I think the new house was built somewhere around 2004, if I remember correctly. Strangely, Trent Reznor, the musician from Nine Inch Nails, rented the old house, using the living room area where a few of the murders took place, to create a music studio. When he moved out, he negotiated with the owner to keep the original front door where Susan Atkins scrawled the word pig in blood. And he actually ended up using that door for his studio in New Orleans. It was the front door. But I don't know what happened to it from there. Others would be, the Lizzie Borden House in Fall River, Massachusetts is another I'd like to visit. I've always wanted a greater sense of what her life was like in there with her father. And as much as Breaking Bad was just a TV show involving murder, I'd love to visit Walter White's house to throw a pizza on the roof. Apparently I'm too late, however, as so many other people have done it, the owner finally installed a 6-foot-high fence. Oh, I also live close to the home where Jodi Arias murdered Travis Alexander, so I'm sure I'll take a drive past that one too at some point before I move. Okay, so I'm going to answer two more questions, and it doesn't look like I'll get through all of them again, so I'll keep the rest on hand and definitely answer them as appropriate in future episodes. I have a really complex one here about the relationship between evolution and capitalism, among other considerations, but I'm running behind in my production schedule at the moment, so I'm going to save that for an upcoming episode. It's a great question. So here are two more that resonated with me. What scares you the most? Definitely failure. The thought of leaving this world without accomplishing my dreams and goals is a tough pill to swallow, but one we're forced to take regardless of how much or how little we perceive ourselves as being successful when the time arrives. For me, I think it's more so about having an opportunity to live my best life, so to speak, in a genuine manner conducive to who I am. Like most people, I've had to fight my way through jobs and relationships that weren't right for me and didn't bring forth the best that I have to offer. So I'm not sure we ever arrive, so to speak, in the sense that we see ourselves as reaching the peak of happiness and success. There will always be struggle, no matter the path you choose. But if you find success within your struggle, and it's the battle you were always meant to fight, and the hill you know is worth dying on, then there's a lot of comfort in knowing you chose the right path in this world. If anything, I think all of us fear one thing more than any other, which equates to this: wasting our lives. So, yeah, I believe my greatest fear is living a life absent of my true purpose on Earth. That's for sure. Okay, last one. This one is really charming to me for whatever reason, so I definitely want to address it in this episode. There's just something about its simplicity that makes it truly profound. So the question is, what do you miss? Wow. I mean, that really sums up who we are as living, breathing, mortal humans. Our lives and our identity are just these things that constantly slip through our grasp, year by year, day by day, and even minute by minute. What we look like, the last job we had, our best friend in college, the relationship we had with our grandparents, the first time we tasted ice cream or kissed somebody, that feeling of an adult letting go of your bike to let you ride on two wheels for the first time as a kid, the great ending to that book that left you wishing you could just crawl up inside that fantasy world forever. The last hug that person gave you before dying. Dropping your kid off at school for the first time, and as they disappear inside, you wonder why they can't just stay babies forever. These are the things. The moments. I think that's what it is for me. It's the moments that loss takes away. We grow up, move on, decay, and are reborn, in many ways. Then we die. But those memories don't. They stay with us. We look back upon them, sometimes in pain, sometimes with joy, yet always with the realization they're gone. I miss all of those things. We're told to live in the moment, but it's difficult. I miss being 3 years old and holding my mother's hand. I miss the popsicles from the corner store when I was five. I miss playing baseball for the first time. I miss hearing my parents cheer from the stands at my football games. I miss what it was like to party with my friends when I was a teen. I miss feeling like my whole life was ahead of me. I miss feeling invincible, no matter how stupid I was to believe it. I miss the love I shared with people who are no longer in my life. I miss being naive. I miss having the ability to go back to the place I used to call home. Everything gained in this life becomes something that will eventually be lost. It's ironic that our reality dictates the more we have, the more we hurt when losing it. If I look back and think about what I miss, damn, it really stings a lot. It's crushing. To live is to suffer. But to live despite the suffering is the best life we'll ever know. So, I hope the rest of my days follow suit in smashing my heart to bits. Yours too. Because it all comes to an end. And when it does, that pain of the past will not be due to suffering. It will be a product of success. Because you had the courage to live, love, and let the world slip from your grasp as you learn to fly anyway. Maybe that's why angels have wings.